This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're going to start with GE. Very few global conglomerates reach a level of pop culture awareness that they're actually featured prominently in a network sitcom.
I have a plan to quadruple profits by the year 2015.
How are you possibly going to do that?
The old-fashioned way, Jack. I'm going to shut it down. I'm going to shut the whole thing down for 2 years. I mean, imagine how badly people will want light bulbs then.
Are you insane? Think about the jobs, the economy. This is GE.
It's just GE now, Jack. I sold the E to Samsung. They're Samsung now.
That, of course, is a scene from 30 Rock. And okay, admitted, the show's concept was a little meta, but it really does underscore just how well-known GE and its brand is. Now, GE looms even larger here in Boston, especially after famously relocating its headquarters here in 2016, only to scale back on their big plans in the years that followed that. So what do we make then of today's news that the company is going to break into three pieces and will be selling some pieces off? There's a lot to get into there, but let's just start with what exactly GE is going to do. For that, we are joined by Bloomberg reporter Ryan Bean. Ryan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So, Ryan, in a nutshell, what is GE doing? What are these three pieces and what are they doing with them?
Right. So, essentially, GE today announced that they're going to split up their primary industrial businesses into three separate publicly traded standalone companies. It's going to start early in 2023 with the spinoff of GE Healthcare. That's the unit that manufactures and services medical scanners such as x-ray machines and CT scanners and provides pharmaceutical diagnostics as well. Then a year later, in early 2024, after GE combines its fossil fuel power equipment division with its renewable energy division that makes wind turbines and a digital business that primarily operates in the energy space, they will be spinning off that newly combined entity, again, as a standalone company in early 2024. That will leave the jet engine business, GE Aviation, combined with a few other remaining assets, namely a large book of runoff long-term care reinsurance policies that will be left with the aviation division.
Okay, so there's going to be these three things. There's going to be a healthcare company, there's going to be an energy company, there's going to be an aviation company. When you say spin off, does that mean they're going to sell them? They're going to belong to someone else?
Well, the in the case of healthcare, spin-off just typically means it's going to sort of separate away from the main entity. It will become a publicly traded entity on its own. GE at this point anticipates maintaining about a 19.9% stake in the separated GE healthcare company, whatever they decide to call that when that happens in early 2023. Now, the capital structures of each of these newly independent separated entities has yet to be determined with precision, as has the full makeup of their leadership teams, which are two pretty big things that the companies need to kind of work through over the next few years as these plans play out.
Ryan, who's going to be GE? Are they all GE? Do we have three different GEs, or is one of them GE and the other two are going to be something else?
Yeah, it's a great question. We actually just wrote a little piece about this. It's unclear at this point. They haven't made any decisions about branding, about who will get to carry on with the more than a century old monogram logo, you know, the famous script GE that we've seen on everything from appliances to light bulbs to jet engines to even the jerseys of the Boston Celtics. They haven't decided that yet, but that's going to be something that obviously they'll need to figure out.
Okay, so these are big changes, and those are some really big unknowns. What have you been hearing from inside the company? Have you heard anything? I mean, that's a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, well, I spoke to CEO Larry Culp earlier today, and you know, the message that he was really driving home was by separating these businesses out, giving them some more independence will really allow them to focus more on their customers, more on their end markets, and not have to be sort of beholden to, you know, the situations that other parts of their businesses were in when they were all a combined entity, right? So part of this sort of reflects the shifting in.
So I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you just because,
yeah.
Again, you know, for listeners who are not deep in this, are you saying that basically it was too big and too hard to manage when it was that complicated, and to do a better job for customers, they got to get smaller?
Essentially, yeah. If you look at the history of corporate America over the last few decades, conglomerates like GE that play in lots of different industries have increasingly fallen out of favor. Investors increasingly favor much more focus and so-called pure play companies. And that's sort of what they're trying to do here. They're trying to get smaller. They're trying to get a little bit more focused. And, you know, if the jet engine business is doing great, they don't want to be saddled with a struggling power business. Or during the pandemic, the healthcare division was doing very well. But the jet engine division, due to the drop off in flying, the near halt in all global air travel for much of 2020, the jet engine business struggled mightily. It used to be thought that by having a variety of different businesses in different industries, when one was doing poorly or when some are doing poorly, others would be doing better depending on where they were in the industrial cycle.
All right. So, you know, the stock market, industry analysts, people out there who have a lot of money invested, do they like this move by GE? Does this make them happy or does it make them say, uh-oh, what's been going wrong?
I think, you know, GE investors have been hoping for a little bit of a simpler story for this company for a long time. The stock went up a significant amount. Early pre-market trading, I think, was up somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 17%. Since the market's open for normal trading, it's paired some of those gains. It's now up a little less than 3% after yesterday's close. Investors have been hoping for a simpler story for a long time. One of the big knocks against GE and one of the big reasons why its valuation collapsed from being the most valuable company in the world 20 years ago is because its far-flung operations could contain a trouble that would not necessarily present itself to the public or to investors until it was too late, until there was a massive bill to pay. So the company's been under pressure for a while now to simplify itself, to sort of make things a little bit clearer and easier for investors to understand.
Briefly, last question. Will people lose jobs and will they lose them here?
That's to be determined. I will say this, though, when Larry Kolb was on Bloomberg TV earlier today, he did say that he anticipates that he would not be surprised. Forgive me, I'm trying to get his words right. He would not be surprised if the GE team didn't grow over the next few years. They're targeting growth now as part of these moves.
All right. We will watch it. That's Ryan Bean, Bloomberg reporter who's been tracking this story. Ryan, thanks for joining us here on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
All right. So that's what's happening. Now let's talk a little bit more about what it could mean, especially for us here. We have two guests to help us do that. First, John Barrows, former chief of economic development for the city of Boston under former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. John, thanks for joining us.
Tiziana, great to be on. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Also, Larry Edelman, financial columnist and associate editor for the Boston Globe. Larry, thanks to you, too.
Sure thing.
So, John, this is a far cry from 2016 when we open a new headquarters for GE here. They're going to build big buildings, you know, lots of financial promise. What's your reaction to the news and what we just heard from Ryan Bean?
Yeah, I think what Ryan said is exactly what we've known for the last few decades, that, you know, essentially the multi-industry conglomerate, you know, was an old dinosaur and we needed to move in a different direction. So this is not a surprise. I mean, I didn't know the details and nobody really knew the details of how GE was going to separate the business, become leaner. But GE has shed, I think, over $72 billion in debt over the last 5 years or so, really made some moves and tried to become a more efficient company, a better company. And I still think the reasons why GE came to Boston, Tiziana, still exists. Strong fundamentals, great talent pool, great place for it to rethink itself and be innovative and continue to grow. Larry Culp is a growth guy, right? So I think he's here because those things continue to be true.
So, Larry Edelman, I'll turn to you now. I'm, you know, echoing in my head is a conversation we had earlier this year with former GE CEO Jeff Immelt. He wrote a book kind of defending his moves in the roughly 16 years that he ran the company, which were heavily criticized. We've heard both from John and from Ryan that conglomerates in general, that beast doesn't work anymore. What is your take on how much of this is the nature of the beast versus missteps, management issues inside GE specifically?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with missteps that were taken within inside GE. One of those missteps being, you know, not getting rid of the conglomerate structure faster. It was clear it wasn't working, and yet they stuck with it way too long. But that wasn't the only mistake. And, you know, there's always this, it's gotten kind of tiresome argument over whether Jeffrey Immelt was the guy who dragged down the great company that Jack Welch built. But it's more complicated than that. But Immelt made two really big missteps. One was buying a French power generation company that proved, you know, he had to make so many concessions to the French government to complete that deal that it really negated a lot of the benefits that they saw coming from it. And at the same time, demand for gas turbines really plummeted after that deal closed. And the second one was buying the Baker Hughes Oilfield Services Company. Essentially, Immelt doubled down on the oil business just before, you know, oil prices tanked. And they really paid the cost for those. And finally, there were these accounting issues, both in the power business and in the long-term care business, that really dented GE's reputation for, you know, being a top-notch financial company.
We're talking about the news today that GE is splitting into three pieces. Our guests are Larry Edelman of the Boston Globe and John Barros, former Boston Chief of Economic Development. John, I want to turn back to you here. So the missteps that Larry was just talking about that former GE Chief Jeff Immelt made had to do with energy. And we just heard from Ryan Bean three pieces that this company's breaking out into: healthcare, energy, and roughly what's being called aviation. You said a minute ago, I think they came to Boston for the right reasons, and Boston's still a great place for them to be. Is that, you know, where? These three companies, we don't know what's going to happen to them. 2023 is when healthcare spins off, energy after that. It's not clear which one's going to carry the GE brand. What is the marriage you would look for the city between what will someday be some other GE and the city?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think we've got some strengths here and an argument for all three. Clearly a strong healthcare sector, one that continues to grow. I think we've got the most vibrant sector in the globe when we think about the life science sector here in Boston, and particularly our participation during the pandemic in a response to COVID-19. When we look at aviation, Tiziana, they have an operation in Lynn that's pretty important to the work they do. They just doubled down and made another $4.2 or $4.6 million investment in workforce in the area. I know they're pretty bullish about the GV aviation franchise. And then, you know, with renewable energy, you know, Boston, you know, has, again, the talent, an innovative culture. We have, I think, the political leadership. I think, you know, Michelle Wu bodes well, if you would, as the elected newly elected mayor for the city and a potential partner in the space for GE. When we courted GE, we pitched the city as a partner in thinking about the new GE, and I think we could still be that city for GE.
John, I want to stay with you for a second, then I'll go back to Larry. What should Mayor-elect Michelle Wu's message to GE be right now, both from a positive sort of courtship, but also a, hey, you're here, these are big changes, you made promises, here's what I expect, both?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the mayor should reach out to GE and say, you know, Boston still wants to be your home. We still have the talent. We still have the right culture. And we have government that is forward looking, government that understands the kind of changes and investments we need to make in power and in renewable energy. And we want to continue to be a partner. We don't want to lose those jobs. We don't want to lose GE.
So, Larry Edelman, you know, you're a financial columnist. I'll come back to you here and ask you to make sense of a couple of things. One, what's happening with GE's stock today? Because we'll have lots of people who may own GE stock, or it may be in some portfolio of theirs. Some people don't own any stock. I acknowledge that fully. But for those who do, and so explain that maybe a little bit. And also, we have a lot of people who are big investors, big institutional investors, banks, et cetera, here in Boston. The financial moves here, what do those mean for our economy as well?
Okay, let's start with your second piece of that question first. Let's keep in mind that GE has never been a big presence in Massachusetts. I mean, in Boston itself, prior to the move of the headquarters here. You know, in 2016, when they announced the move, they had over 5,000 people in Massachusetts already. Now they have about 3,300. Only 200 people moved up into the headquarters. From a kind of impact of jobs and so forth, this is not a big deal for Massachusetts at all. And if anything, we overhyped how much of an impact it would be when they picked Boston over other places. As far as what's going on in the stock market today, you know, I think that the modest rise in the stock price today is a positive reflection that GE is doing something to what they like to call unlock value for investors. Clearly, the model of the three businesses under one roof wasn't working well enough, and I think there's some optimism that this breakup will increase value by creating more focused companies. The way the spinoff works is that shareholders, current GE shareholders, will get the stock of these new companies, the healthcare company, the power company, and then what's left of GE, which is the aviation business. So we'll have three different stocks. Maybe it'll do better. There have been some spinoffs that have worked quite well for investors. So it's just too early to tell now because the details aren't out there about how much these companies might be worth overall.
John, I've been inside a big company as an outside contractor when they were going through big restructuring, and I remember how anxiety-provoking those unknowns are for the people who work there. What are we likely, you know, what are people who work for GE thinking and feeling today, and who needs to steward them and protect their interests over these next couple of years?
Yeah, great question. I've actually talked to a couple today, and you know, change is uneasy, right? Change raises all types of questions. One was a little bit more positive than the other, feeling like GE's commitment to the area was long term. They still think, you know, there's a path forward to grow, and the other employee had some questions. I do know that both felt that GE did a good job of communicating this. One was surprised a little bit about where, you know, so some of the announcements, but I guess you have to do that as a public company. And there wasn't, you know, the kind of panic sometimes that you get with these big changes. But you're right, Tiziana, there's definitely some questions, and someone's got to be making sure that the team over there, the employees, are well informed and feeling like there is a lot of promise in front of them, even with all these changes.
And Larry Edelman, what are you going to watch for? So again, I want to go back to that 2023 number when they say the healthcare business, which is the first split or spinoff, will be ready to go. What do you watch for between now and then in the healthcare industry, how it affects healthcare here in Boston, our economy? What are you going to watch?
Well, I think it's going to be an issue of how fast they try to build up that company. Remember, the healthcare business is based in Chicago, but we do have an operation out near Westboro for GE. So, you know, we'll see how their employment holds up out there. You know, I think that's of the three businesses, as an investor, I would want to be in the healthcare business versus the carbon reliant, you know, power business and the aviation business. So that could be the growth vehicle for GE going forward.
All right. That is Larry Edelman, financial columnist and associate editor for the Boston Globe, and John Barros, former chief of economic development for the city of Boston under former Mayor Marty Walsh. Larry, thanks.
Thank you.
John, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
Tomorrow, it's expected that Pfizer is going to ask federal regulators to expand the authorization of the company's COVID-19 booster shot to include all Americans. Now, this comes after emergency use authorization for a children's version of their vaccine last week. And more than 500 sites are online in the Commonwealth to deliver those doses to kids. And again, we're talking kids 5 to 11 with that. We've heard over and over again from public health officials, health experts, vaccination is our way out of this pandemic. Well, we're headed into the colder weather. Thanksgiving's around the corner, indoor gatherings. Are we close to getting out from under this with these moves, with what's ahead? Let's ask Dr. Shira Durone. Dr. Durone is an infectious disease physician, hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Durone, welcome back.
Wonderful to be here.
So I want to start with boosters. We've talked to you a lot about them. And I suspect that there will be some people who will hear, wait a minute, people can already get Pfizer boosters. What is it that Pfizer is asking for? So remind us, who right now is qualified to get a booster under the guidance by the FDA and the CDC?
Well, it's a lot of people, but it isn't all people. So it's everyone who got J&J. So everyone 18 and older who got J&J, and no one under 18 has been authorized to get that vaccine. And then for those who received Pfizer and Moderna, it's anyone 18 and over with comorbidities, those 18 and over who have institutional or occupational high-risk exposure. Now, early on, the CDC, after the first Pfizer authorization for boosters, the CDC was using some very specific language about who should get a booster and who may get a booster. And so within that broad category, there are those who they really recommend it for and those who they sort of allow it for. With the approvals of the Moderna or the authorization of Moderna and J&J, most of the messaging has really dropped that language, I think, for simplicity's sake. And so, of course, now there is the consideration to expand the authorization beyond those eligibility groups.
So you're 28, you work from home, you got Pfizer or Moderna the first time around, you don't have any asthma, diabetes, obesity, you are not yet eligible for a booster, and this move by Pfizer is seeking to give you the chance to have a booster too.
That's exactly right. And, you know, there are a few reasons why that might make sense at this point in time. And, you know, the ones that have been raised are that effectively the current criteria, eligibility criteria, do encompass almost everyone in this country except that type that you just described, a young, very healthy work from home type. And, you know, that really just leaves out this small group who may want it. They may really want to avoid a case of mild infection, even though they're not at risk for severe disease, hospitalization, and death, because being sick and being put out from, you know, your activities for a 10-day period of isolation can be very difficult. Exposing your unvaccinated children can be very difficult for everyone involved, obviously.
And so would you encourage folks, should this go forward? And again, Pfizer is going to ask federal regulators to authorize this. We're not there yet. Should federal regulators accede, I can't quite figure out the word that I want, say yes, would you advise people in those categories to take that extra step?
I think the other thing that we know now that boosters have been now that we've been giving boosters here and elsewhere for a couple of months now, is that we now have safety data on boosters, real world safety data, and it is very safe. And so, you know, your question, to answer your question, we've talked about this before, we do have a public health messaging problem. Mm-hmm. What are we trying to achieve with the vaccination campaign? Are we trying to prevent severe disease, hospitalization, and death? In which case the answer is no, we don't need to authorize boosters or give boosters to younger, healthier people. Or are we actually trying to prevent all infection, if possible, with vaccination? I think, you know, the statements that I've heard from FDA officials and White House officials, et cetera, in recent weeks have sort of led me to believe that the national vaccine plan is really trying to be geared more toward the latter, toward preventing any infection, if possible, at least with one more go around of boosters. Now, if it turns out that these boosters only raise our antibody levels for a few months again, and that that protection wanes again, and that we become susceptible to mild infection again, then I think we need to revisit that, that at that time. And we need to ask ourselves as a society, how often are we willing to do this to prevent, you know, essentially what is virus in the nose, what is for most people at this point, a common cold-like illness. You know, is this worth the resources that we're putting into it?
And it sounds like you're saying, Dr. Daron, we don't know yet. We don't know yet if this is a one-time booster or, like the flu, you're getting your COVID shot every fall.
We don't know if this boost will be the boost that we need to keep those antibody levels high to prevent both, you know, nose infection and systemic organ infection, or whether we will keep having the that upper respiratory protection wane. It isn't really like flu. Flu mutates so quickly that you need an annual shot in order to prevent even the severe complications of influenza. In this case, the issue is really that what wanes is that protection against asymptomatic and mild infection, much, much more so than the protection against severe disease, hospitalization, and death. That being said, the Israeli data are showing that the booster program is protecting younger populations against severe disease as well, to a lesser extent, but to a detectable extent. And that's another reason why it's being considered for a broader age range right now.
All right. You brought up younger populations, and that's where I want to go next, because, of course, you and I are talking about the booster, right? But that is happening at the same time that around the country and here in the Commonwealth, we are beginning to roll out in earnest now vaccinations that were authorized for emergency use, Pfizer vaccinations, smaller dose for kids ages 5 to 11. You may or may not have seen that the Boston Globe is reporting just today that Boston school officials announced the school district is shutting down the Curley K through 8 school in Jamaica Plain for 10 days due to a rising number of COVID-19 cases. And that's across multiple grade levels and classrooms. I think we all thought and hoped that we might no longer be in that place. I'm sure as people hear that news, they will say, is this the beginning of some kind of surge again? Is this because kids haven't been vaccinated yet? What do I think about this? And what does this mean for where we are in the pandemic? Now, again, you may not have even heard that news yet. But let me simplify by saying, where are we today in this pandemic? Are we dead in the middle of it on the back end, but we're still going to see some spikes? We don't know because we're headed into the colder weather and we don't know what this year is going to look like.
If there's one thing we do know about this virus, is that we don't know what it's going to do next. It is so unpredictable. And, you know, in the beginning, we used to talk about the models all the time. And you'll notice that we rarely talk about the models anymore because they are always wrong. We have so little understanding about what this virus is going to do and where it's headed at any given moment. So, you know, I think what we were able to show here in New England is that even in the face of a surge of cases due to a much more highly transmissible variant, we were able to keep hospitalizations and deaths relatively at bay, a much more flat or small increase in those numbers. And so immunity will do that for us. We are unlikely to ever see a surge of hospitalization and death that parallels anything we saw during the first two waves. But that doesn't mean that we won't see hills and valleys for years to come that are probably seasonal in nature, so more so in cold weather, that may be related to new and different variants that could be more contagious yet, variants that could be immune evasive. So I don't think we're certainly not, you know, past the point where something bad could happen, but we are very well protected by vaccination.
Based on what we know with our current vaccination rates here in the Commonwealth, with what we know about the science of risks for various age groups, et cetera, parents who hear that news about the Curley school today, I think they're going to ask, are my kids safe in school? On balance, are kids in the Commonwealth safe in their in-person learning?
Absolutely. You know, there is no zero risk. But what we have seen from now what is nearly 2 years of real world data with different approaches in different countries to in-person schooling, with much of the world having actually had full-time in-person school without masks through various surges of cases, is that in general, the children have fared well. And of course, children do get very sick with COVID-19 and die. And that's why the vaccine was unequivocally authorized for this latest younger age group. But that the risks and benefits overall of education and schooling for these kids, both now and in the future, favors them going to school, even in the face of a circulating virus and an ongoing pandemic.
So we've talked before on the show, and you and I on the show have talked before about people's risk tolerance, and there can be a gap between sort of what public policy says, what the science says, what individual risk tolerance is. I'm thinking about masks in schools here, thinking about the fact that, you know, in the last mayoral debate before she was elected mayor-elect, Michelle Wu said masks aren't coming off in Boston public schools. And then last week we had Governor Charlie Baker say when a school reaches 80% of its population, you know, faculty, teachers, staff, students vaccinated, they can choose to take masks off. Right there is two different public leaders looking at the same information and making different decisions. Is that the way it's going to be for a while, that it's just going to depend on the risk tolerance of a particular community and the discretion of a particular leader? Or could we get to a point foreseeable, right, like, you know, this academic year, where there's a pretty good consensus about what's safe and what's not?
I've been struggling with that question myself. I don't know how we get people to a place where they can agree on that question, because people have such strong feelings on both sides of that argument. You know, people feel on one side that, you know, what really are the downsides of masks if they prevent some transmission in schools and outside of schools? And, you know, that we want to avoid things like the story you just told me about a school closing and children being sent home to remote learning, which we know is harmful to them. And on the other side, you have people who feel very strongly that masks are interfering with their children's learning and their social development and their language development, and that they are, you know, low risk by virtue of their youth, that they are now getting vaccinated, that having an off-ramp, an end game to the masks and other mitigations that are being used in schools is actually incentive to vaccinate. I'm hearing more and more, why should I vaccinate my child if they're just going to have to do all the same things and be subject to the same restrictions anyway? So that's a real concern that I have. But I don't know how we find that common ground, given that making masks optional for each child and each family doesn't seem to be going over well, partly because we messaged so strongly, especially in the early phase of the pandemic, my mask protects you and your mask protects me. So people don't want to give individuals the choice on this matter. And I think that we are going to see some rising levels of divisiveness and anger over the next few months as we see districts choosing and not choosing to take advantage of the 80% vaccination mandate waiver option.
All right. That is Dr. Shira Doron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, friend of the show over these months with Ask the Doctors. Dr. Doron, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Imagine more than 250 neighborhood voices talking to each other in intimate conversation about what's important to them, to their families, to their communities. And now imagine you can search those voices to hear their ideas firsthand. And an artificial intelligence engine can read them too, telling you which issues come up the most, where people's pain points are, what they need most. It's called Real Talk for Change, and the portal launched late last month. The goal, uplift voices usually left out of policy conversations and use those voices to hold policymakers accountable for what they do. Deb Roy helped develop Real Talk for Change, and Zakia Alake facilitated conversations. Deb's a project lead with Real Talk for Change and the director of MIT's Center for Constructive Conversations. And Zakia works with Dunk the Vote and is lead trainer and a facilitator with Real Talk for Change. Deb, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Zakia, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
So, Deb, I'm going to start with you. As of the end of October, 55 conversations, more than 250 voices recorded from community members all across the city. In all of that, what have you learned matters most to people, Deb?
Sure. Thank you. And actually, I'm just looking at the live portal, and we're over 300 people now that are that have participated. There's some themes that really have been prevalent around housing, around public health and economic opportunity and discrimination, these and other themes are actually how the voices are organized in the portal that's now made public and visible.
So, Zakia, Deb's given us sort of the aggregate view there across all those voices, more than 300 now. It's fascinating when it's almost like one of those pointillist paintings, right? Where when you look really close, it's lots of little dots. And then when you step back, you see the picture. You were on the ground facilitating the little dots. What did you hear? Are those the same themes you heard in these personal conversations around these tables?
Absolutely. And the major point I want to make with you is I lead with this when I'm presenting to community groups, trying to encourage them to take place and take part in these conversations. There's an old West African proverb that goes like this: when an elder dies, the village loses a library. This represents a way for us to preserve civic engagement libraries across the city.
Deb, is that what you imagined? Is this a library of what matters to people, of their own voices and their lived experiences that can live beyond them?
It is. I mean, I learned about this proverb and from Zakia, and I think it's really a beautiful way to think about what Real Talk for Change represents, and really the underlying idea of bringing together people and technology in a new way, where we have, the wisdom and some of the, you might call it, ancient social technologies or methods of facilitated dialogue, which Zakia, both practices and has been helping others into through trainings, on one hand, combined with a set of digital technologies, which can in some important ways, not just amplify, but connect and potentially transform the impact of small group facilitated conversations by recording those voices, preserving them in that online library Zakia describes, but also with tools that we're developing and human-led methods, listening, analyzing, finding patterns that connect our conversations and connect our experiences, and make those connections and those themes visible for all of us to see. Those are all parts of what you might say it makes this this online library special.
I want to get to some of the voices in that library. I was in the portal exploring it today. You've curated, as you said, Deb, the big themes. There's some sample voices right at the top, or you can really delve in and hear more. Zakia, here's Claudette in Dorchester.
What are we looking for?
So I think we don't have that sound when we've got it. We'll get it back. Let's try
again.
I got
a few questions. Mine is, one of them is, what does the climate control look like? Because there's a concern about the water levels rising. And what does that look like? And who is in charge of that? project that needs to be discussed with the homeowners and the business owners and the commuters and all the people that can be affected.
So what strikes me there, Zakiya, is that question about who's in charge, who's responsible, because that's really part of the accountability side of this equation too, right? It's not just to hear people's voices, but to be able to say to policymakers, you know what people care about. It's right there. What are you doing? Is that right, Zakiya? Is that accountability a piece of this? And can we do that in a different way with this kind of approach?
We can do this in several ways with this kind of approach. Right now, Mayor-elect Michelle Wu is charged with replacing many people who've been sitting on boards and commissions for the city of Boston since Walsh became mayor in 2013. And some of those very seats are for things like the Harbor Watch or something like that. I can't think of one off the top of my head. But Claudette, who we just listened to, might not know that. And she might be somebody who wants to keep a close watch on what is going on with climate activity by the city of Boston. It sounds like she's interested. She's somebody that I could connect to community organizations like Alternatives for Community and Environment, the Roxbury Environmental Empowerment Project, right in Nubian Square, which sits in Nubian Square but looks far beyond that to the environmental issues that impact low-income communities in Boston. So there's connecting people to the elected officials, but also pointing out to community activists or would-be activists like Claudette, hey, there's a way for you to be involved as well and connect with other activists across the city.
I want to stay with that thread. And Deb, I'm going to play some more sound here. This time we have Alejandro in East Boston.
I graduated 2 years ago from a Boston public high school, and I felt that my high school, compared to like other high schools like in the Boston area, didn't receive as much funding. We're located, I know, like in Newbury Street, and I know like a lot of the people that lived in that area didn't want my school to be there. So I don't know if that had like any play in like whether how much money we got.
So real practical questions by a Boston Public School graduate about how funding works. It strikes me, Deb, there's a story in the Globe just this morning about Mayor-elect Wu feeling some urgency around school investments and improvements. How do you imagine people using the portal to organize and activate around these issues and for public policy leaders to use the portal to inform themselves?
Sure. Well, one thing I'll just point out, first of all, in hearing just that short audio clip is I wonder how many of us have walked past a school or through a neighborhood that we don't have any personal direct connection, even though we might be local and in the neighborhood. I just find just the ability to have these windows into people's lives that they are caring to share open up as, one of the motivating reasons for having gotten into this effort is to kind of create those openings so that we have an ability to understand and hear some of the voices of people who are in our midst, but we may not have occasion otherwise to do. In terms of the accountability and how this would connect with decision makers who are setting policy, leaders in our city, we already had a first example where both mayoral candidates participated in public forums the week before the November 2nd election, where we highlighted some of the themes. Again, more than just the power of a single story, the fact that these stories are connected to one another, which is the way the portal is organized, is a reminder that these are not kind of random or even, hand-selected single stories or experiences that that someone might found powerful, but rather fit into this larger theme and that's being experienced by many. We've been able to bring essentially this kind of data-grounded view and this qualitative side of hearing voices into public events with both mayoral candidates, where I think if you know your audience members should go and through the portal, you can actually view these public forums that were televised with both candidates. Just the nature of what happens when the candidates are essentially in dialogue with some of the people who participate in these conversations. It requires a kind of connection at that human level. And yet there is a accountability kind of built into the system because of the transparency through which voices move through this system. And there's a sense-making process to elevate these themes and these voices. We're planning another event now with, Michelle Wu is our mayor, perhaps later this year. These are steps towards what we hope will be an enduring new kind of communication space, where we hope Mayor Wu will continue to be in dialogue with people of the city of Boston, including people. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. We have limited time, and there's a little bit more I want to get to. You just referred to some of these statements, questions that were played at that forum, and I just want our listeners to be able to hear one of those. So this is Janir from Dorchester.
The neighborhood doesn't look the same, doesn't feel the same, and everybody's being pushed out for big developments and 500,000-600,000 townhouse condos, and the taxes are so high. How are you supposed to afford keep where you stay at?
And then here's Kenyatta from Roxbury.
I was a single mom, and because I couldn't afford an education, I couldn't get those high-paying jobs. You know, if I got the experience, years of experience, but I don't have the education, when is that going to count again?
So, Deb, I want to turn to Zakiya here and get one more thought from you, Zakiya. It's hard to talk about yourself this way. It's hard to share your personal experiences and the anxiety of your questions. Did people willingly come to the table, and do you think there's a lot of promise of people wanting to continue this dialogue?
Well, see, that's the genius of MIT's strategy. Janair was actually recruited by me. How did that happen? I'm a trusted leader in her community. So when I went to her one-on-one, and that's the thing, MIT and its partners like Dunk the Vote allowed people like me a lot of time to invest in recruiting people, both for the conversations, and eventually Janair has become a facilitator. She started off as a participant in a conversation, but she got so excited about it, she became a facilitator.
So we're going to have to stop there. What a rich conversation. Such great voices. We just heard Zakiya Alakay, who's lead trainer and facilitator with Real Talk for Change, and Deb Roy, a project lead with Real Talk for Change and the director of MIT's Center for Constructive Conversations. Thank you both for the project and for joining us today. Deb, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Zakiya, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
It's realtalkforchange.org. We'll have more information on our website. That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.